Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how the microbiome and your immune system work together. University of Calgary study. We're also going to take a look at physical inactivity. And by the way, most people are not physically active enough. Then they don't get a good night's sleep. With that combination, puts you at a big time risk for obesity. University of Exeter Medical School. And how eating just one food strengthens the beneficial brainwave frequencies. Loma Linda University, and I'll tell you what that food is, and how melatonin and coenzyme Q10 are good for one condition that millions of Americans suffer from daily, and it can turn it right off. University of California, Los Angeles, and a lot more on health and healing. I'm not going to go as in-depth today on the nutrition as I normally would because I got a really good response from people who we're interested in the story, and this is a story, in order to make sense, I had to take you back to the beginning. The people who controlled the oil industry, the barons of oil, these were people who had all the money in the world. There was a time when John D. Rockefeller was the richest man in America, and he and others got together, and they decided how medicine should be done. Up until that point, almost all medicine was homeopathic. There were many homeopathic schools. All those were closed down. And instead, pharmaceutical medicine was the whole emphasis. Drugs that they or companies they controlled, not necessarily companies that had their name on it, would gain the profit. Whether or not these medicines cured people is irrelevant. It would certainly give them power over medicine. Today, these same corporations or their descendants or heirs control molecular biology. But between today's so-called miracles of molecular biology and the people who went from the Industrial Revolution and fossil fuels, there was a period of time where they came up with an idea starting in about the 1850s and accelerating to what really took on a life of its own by the 1940s and 30s, that not everybody was equal, that we should have one group of people always in control. These were the purebreds. These were the upper-level people. All right, what about everyone else? Well, they were undesirable. And I actually have found writings, and we will be presenting these to an outstanding documentary from James Corbett, that these people should be killed. Now, we're not talking about Nazi Germany. In fact, it was the Nazis and their whole idea of first killing off the mentally incompetent or feeble-minded to keep the Aryan genes strong that led to many of the consequences and justifications for genocide against Jews and communists and anyone else that they felt was of an inferior being. They didn't create that. That was created in the United States. And who was one of the leading eugenicists? Margaret Sanger. Why aren't any of her monuments being torn down? She actively agitated for sterilization of women, which became the law. And you were never asked for consent. You simply could sterilize anyone who you felt was feeble-minded. That was generally poor people, people out of work, or those they call feeble-minded. And you're going to learn a lot about this. And people that you would never assume would be associated with such a movement, like George Bernard Shaw, the great playwright, were part of this. And when eugenicists was no longer a good name, they put it into genetic hygiene. They changed and morphed the name to disguise the underlying intents. So when you see a clip of Bill Gates advocating for population control, and you see that the vaccines in Africa that were widely used, tetanus vaccines, and in those vaccines, there were contraceptive ingredients, and they were given to specific people, not whites, not educated blacks, but the indigenous populations. This was discovered by some doctors who happened to be Catholic, and then they started doing research, and they found out that all the hospitals in this whole area of Africa have been using this, and that causes a woman not to be able to conceive, makes her infertile. Were the women asked? Were the husbands asked? Was anyone asked? No. So, like Ted Turner and others who believe in population control, you can certainly argue, and legitimately so, do we have enough resources for all the people on the planet now and in the future? Some will say, yes, we have plenty of resources. They're just disproportionately given where they're overabundant in one area and under given in another area. Where others will say, we only have one finite planet, so shouldn't we better manage our resources, and shouldn't we shift to a plant-based diet, which then would be able to feed everyone without stressing our natural resources or polluting the environment or creating global warming? So there are legitimate arguments that can be made. But one argument that is not legitimate is because of a person's wealth and social position and endowing foundations like the Global Growth Initiative type of foundations, that we don't want certain people alive on the planet. We don't want certain people born. Who gives you that right? Who says that you have the right to say who should have a child or not? And if you believe that, then why don't you come on television to debate some of us who would offer a counterpoint of view and let the public decide? So that's what you're going to hear today. We're going to strip bare for the first time. This is stuff you are not aware of. We're going to strip bare and take it to the deepest level of scholarship and historical fact. We've been lied to. We've been manipulated. This is the deep state. These are the people that control the deep state. They control the media. They control what gets out. So that's all going to be revealed today. This is part two today. It'll be a little longer than the last part. Let's begin. There's a study at the University of Calgary, and they looked at the concept of bacteria. Now, as you know, many people associate the word bacteria with something that's dirty and disgusting. But anyone who knows about nutrition disagrees. You would have to, because what is called now the micro, M-I-C-R-O, biome, B-I-O-M-E. Now, that's the bacteria in our bodies that have all kinds of very good, positive effects on our health. The bacteria we have in our gut actually has beneficial functions for most people. It aids in our digestion. It prevents infection from pathogens and educates our immune system on what to fight. And now a new function of a protein in the gut microbiome revealed potential impacts for those who suffer from inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD. It was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell, and a study showed that the good bacteria, the gut microbiome, regulates pro- and anti-inflammatory cells. Quote from this study, "We found that a protein expressed by gut bacteria called bacterioides works to prevent irritable bowel syndrome by rapidly recruiting white blood cells to kill a cell in the immune system that is responsible for orchestrating this irritable bowel inflammatory process. And we think that this mechanism is likely involved in preventing most people from developing it." So what this is saying is inside your cell, inside your gut, you have good bacteria and you have some bad bacteria. But when you have good bacteria working on your behalf, they can trigger other mechanisms to come to the defense to turn off those bad bacteria to prevent inflammatory conditions. Remember, inflammation in the body, that's what leads to all those conditions, diabetes, cancer cells, damage in your heart, your brain. So it's good to have good bacteria. What would be one way you could get some good bacteria? Sauerkraut, beets, those are all good. Some people in America do a good job of working out. Other people, not so much. And some people, not at all. According to the University of Exeter Medical School, you should really get exercise. Because what they have found is this, that low levels of physical activity and inefficient sleep intensify the effects of genetic risk factors for obesity, and that makes you more susceptible to diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, and cancer. So sometimes people can say, well, you know, I'm not as active as I used to be. You should be more active than what you used to be. The older you get, the more you should exercise. And it really does us a great deal of good. My suggestion would be a minimum of 45 minutes a day, 6 days a week, and combine it with going slow to start, get loosened up, take your pulse before you begin. And if you want to protect yourself from a heart attack or stroke, always, always, always take 2 to 3 high heat unit, that's about 40 to 50,000 heat unit per capsule of cayenne pepper. Take 2,000 milligrams of magnesium citrate and 1,000 milligrams of coenzyme Q10 and 2,000 milligrams of L-carnitine, and you put that in your pocket. And if you ever feel yourself with the chest and the pain, the numbness in the arms, the dizziness, you may be having a heart attack or stroke. Take one of those cayenne peppers because it can turn off a heart attack in seconds. It could save your life, literally. But you also should take one of each of those before you do your workout. That way your blood is naturally thin, the platelets are naturally separated, and that way you can get a good workout and reduce the effects of oxidative stress. Eating just one food can make a big difference in how synchronized your brainwave frequencies are. This new study by researchers at Loma Linda University has found that eating nuts on a regular basis strengthen brainwave frequency associated with cognition, healing, memory, and other key brain function. And this was published in the peer-reviewed FASEB. And why? Why would it work? It's relatively simple. Nuts are one of the most nutrient-dense foods available, with an unrivaled unsaturated fatty acid. It's plant-based, high in fiber, good minerals, good vitamins. But nuts also contain other bioactive compounds such as phytosterols. Phyto, P-H-Y-T-O, phytosterols, S-T-E-R-O-L-S, and phenolic, phen, P-H-E-N, olic, O-L-I-C, antioxidants. So those two things, the phytosterols and the phenolic antioxidants, are extremely important for your brain. They turn off inflammation, they protect your brain from oxidative stress, and they can also help remove a lot of the plaque buildup in the arteries. So an impressive array of studies, large and small from around the world, have now found that people who eat nuts regularly cut the risk of heart disease by as much as 50% compared to those who rarely or never eat nuts. And in fact, the latest study shows this. Eating nuts every day will help lower all-cause mortality. It means all causes of death go down when you eat nuts every day. So the article is entitled Nuts and Brain, Effects of Eating Nuts on Changing Electroencephalograph Brainwaves. But that's what it shows. Now, are some nuts better than others? Yeah, there are. My five top ones would be walnuts, number one, pistachios, almonds, macadamias, all very positive. And then it's kind of a tie between filberts, Brazil nuts. Those are all good. By the way, peanut is not a nut. It's a legume. And then seeds, sunflower, pumpkin, sesame, chia, flax, hemp, all six outstanding. And finally, from the University of California, melatonin and coenzyme Q10 together can help turn off migraines. How bad are migraines? Well, over 12% of the American population have them on a regular basis, more often than women, and generally between the ages of 30 and 39. And it can be really severe. But if you're taking melatonin and coenzyme Q10 together, it can stop it. So, yes, there are other ways. Get rid of the caffeine. Get rid of cheeses. And because there are certain chemicals that trigger headaches and constrict the flow of blood into the brain. And so you want to stay away from wines because of the chemicals used in the processing of wines and also cheeses. But relaxation techniques, cognitive therapy, aerobic exercise, good sleep hygiene, all those decrease the frequency of migraines. And then having yourself green juices do the same thing. But a study showed that 100 milligrams of coenzyme Q10 three times a day for 3 months and just 1 milligram of melatonin was able to cut down the incidence of migraines substantially. That's the latest on Health and Healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world, and we do indeed have people from all over the world listening each day. We appreciate you tuning in and sharing the information. Tomorrow I'm going to do a brief commentary on what I found out about Donald Trump's statements to the widow of the soldier who was recently killed in Niger. And I then did the following. I decided, how do I know that what the New York Times and all the media are reporting is accurate? How do I know they didn't take part of what he said and not all of it? Well, I managed to get the entire audio clip of what President Trump said to the widow. It is completely different than what we've been reported. So you can challenge him for a lot of things, and legitimately so. But then when someone's doing something that is not legitimate, we have to ask, what is their motive? At the same time, I'm going to show you in that same period of time where we've been focused on Trump and this little identity politics diversion, what have we not been paying attention to? And I'm just taking actual world events, not reported by the mainstream media, but real, that are happening in the last 2 weeks. And then you put the two side by side. If we're putting our energy into A, attacking him on this particular issue, when there are 1,000 other issues you could legitimately attack him on, and B, you're paying no attention to these issues that are impacting hundreds of millions of people, billions of people around the world, then have you lost your sense of priorities of what's important for protecting and informing and helping people throughout the world? So that'll be tomorrow. And for those of you who are curious, is that what he actually said? Or was there more to it? yeah, there was more to it. And you also hear the widow's response in a complete audio clip. But that's for tomorrow. Now we're going to go to part two to show you a very convoluted story about how people that never make the news, who are never condemned, never challenged, but are the most powerful people on the planet, and how what they've got in store for us. Now, I'm not going to get to the end of this story to tell you what they've got planned and how it's actually happening now, especially to our youth. But these guys are smart. But I'm putting the pieces together through the efforts of James Corbett, who we're going to show you how they've been master manipulating everything for decades. Part two, now.
Idea for furthering the eugenic cause. The creation of a eugenics record office to register the genetic background of every single man, woman, and child in America, and eventually the world, so that every person could be categorized by their family line and assigned a genetic rating. Once completed, those with the lowest eugenic value could be eliminated from the gene pool.
So, the idea of eugenics makes its way to America, lands in the lap of Charles Davenport, who approaches the Carnegie Institute for funding, and on the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, they set up this, essentially an institute to study eugenics, and this eventually evolves with some Harriman money into the Eugenics Records Office. So between this initial institute that's set up at Cold Spring Harbor and then the Eugenics Record Office, which is also added to that, you're talking about millions and millions and millions of dollars of funding that's put forward to go out and investigate and find the inferior germplasm, basically. That's how it's often described.
The Rockefeller Foundation's initial contribution to the Eugenics Record Office, a mere $21,650, was a small sum, but it came with clear benefits. Not only the institutional infrastructure and the personnel of the foundation and the prestige of the Rockefeller name itself, but the promise of increased support as the work advanced. And as always, the Rockefellers were true to their word. Rockefeller Foundation researchers like William Welch, the founding director of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, sat on the ERO's board and helped direct its activities. The Rockefellers also provided funds for specific research, like a $10,000 grant to survey New York's Nassau County for the eugenically unfit. And it created sister organizations like the Bureau of Social Hygiene, which cross-pollinated research and researchers with Davenport's own laboratory. John D. Rockefeller Jr. especially showed an interest in Davenport's work right from the start. They kept up a regular correspondence on a number of eugenics issues. In January 1912, when a plan to institutionalize mentally deficient female convicts to stop them from having children was floated, the young Rockefeller heir wrote to Davenport for his thoughts on the scheme. For his part, Jr. declared that, "This plan seems to me an immensely important one. It points out a scientific way of escape from the evils which our courts are intended to correct, but in reality only increase." After Davenport responded that the plan would only work if it included a eugenical screening of the convicts, Jr. contributed $200,000 to found just such an institute. The Institute of Criminology in New York was administered by Rockefeller's own Bureau of Social Hygiene and staffed by workers trained at the Eugenics Record Office. Fueled by the support of America's rich and powerful, the field of eugenics transformed from the quaint hobby horse of a few mad scientists into the social cause of an entire generation. Economists, politicians, authors, activists. By the 1920s, everyone who was anyone was extolling the need to eradicate the germplasm of the lower stock. Marie Stopes, the celebrated family planning pioneer who founded Britain's first birth control clinic in North London in 1921, railed against hordes of defectives, calling for the compulsory sterilization of those she deemed unfit for parenthood. Tommy Douglas, now venerated as a hero in Canada for his role in founding the nation's healthcare system, submitted a master's thesis to McMaster University advocating that subnormals, defectives, and morons, like those with low IQ or physical abnormalities, be isolated on a state farm or in a colony where decisions could be made for them by a competent supervisor, and called on the government to certify mental and physical fitness to stop the unfit from breeding. John Maynard Keynes, the economist who gave us the Keynesian economics school that is still popular among central planners today, was himself president of the British Eugenics Society from 1937 to 1944. Alexander Graham Bell is still revered as the inventor of the telephone, but was in fact an early supporter of Charles Davenport and a founding member of the Eugenic Records Office Board of Scientific Directors. He openly campaigned for the eradication of the deaf race by governments intervening to stop deaf people from marrying. Nobel Prize-winning playwright and author George Bernard Shaw advocated for the creation of a government panel that would require everyone to justify their existence before it. If they failed to do so, Shaw thought those people should be killed by the state. Eventually, with foundation funding and promotion, this eugenicist mindset filtered down into the popular culture. The American Eugenics Society sponsored Fitter Family contests at state fairs, awarding prizes to families scoring the highest on eugenic health tests. The society also sponsored contests to award prizes to clergy who fit the message of eugenics into their sermons. Eugenics even found its way to the silver screen.
Well, we thought it necessary to present your family's case to the state medical commission. And after an examination, they decided there was but one important action to take, to have your entire family sterilized.
Well, what's that?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, we investigated your family's history, Alice. And most of the past three generations have been feeble-minded. Congenital cripples or habitual drunkards. Instead of improving, each generation is more of a problem. Now, in this state, we have a law which provides for such people to have an operation so there won't be any more children.
I see.
But merely popularizing their ideas was not the goal of the eugenicists. They wanted action. And in this case, that meant concrete steps towards eliminating the defective germplasm from the human population. Government-sanctioned murder of those deemed unfit was always one option on the table. And it wasn't just playwrights like Bernard Shaw advocating for government death panels. Eugenicists of all stripes discussed and debated the idea of murdering degenerates as the quickest way of achieving their goals. Mistaken regard for what are believed to be divine laws and a sentimental belief in the sanctity of human life tend to prevent both the elimination of defective infants and the sterilization of such adults as are themselves of no value to the community. The laws of nature require the obliteration of the unfit, and human life is valuable only when it is of use to the community or race. Madison Grant, director of the American Eugenics Society, 1915. But mainstream eugenicists realized that this approach was not possible in the political and judicial climate of the day. As Henry Goddard noted in his infamous study on the Kallikak family, "For the low-grade idiot, the loathsome unfortunate that may be seen in our institutions, some have proposed the lethal chamber, but humanity is steadily tending away from the possibility of that method, and there is no probability that it will ever be practiced." Instead, they would have to turn to the other option, the more politically acceptable solution for stopping the undesirables from breeding: forced sterilization. Indiana passed America's first eugenic sterilization law in 1907, and with only a few years, there were a dozen states where those deemed unfit were being legally sterilized against their will. But still, this was not enough for the eugenicists. The approach was too scattershot. Only a few thousand sterilizations had taken place under these laws, and Indiana's own Forced Sterilization Act was overturned by the state Supreme Court in 1921. Once again, Harry Laughlin, Davenport's right-hand man at the Rockefeller-funded Eugenics Record Office, stepped in to solve the problem. He drafted a model eugenic sterilization law in 1922 that became the basis for Virginia's 1924 Sterilization Act. To confront the issues head-on, the eugenicists decided to challenge the law's constitutionality themselves and take the lawsuit all the way to the Supreme Court. All they needed was the right test case to bring to trial. And they found that case in Carrie Buck, an 18-year-old ward of the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and the Feeble-Minded, who was neither epileptic nor feeble-minded.
So she's a young woman who is growing up in Charlottesville, Virginia, being raised by a single mother. Back then, there was a belief that it was better often to take poor children away from their parents and put them in middle-class homes. So she was put in a foster family that treated her very badly. She wasn't allowed to call the parents mother and father. She did a lot of housekeeping for them and was rented out to the neighbors. And then one summer, she was raped by the nephew of her foster mother. She becomes pregnant out of wedlock. And rather than help her with this pregnancy, they decide to get her declared epileptic and feeble-minded, though she was neither, and she shipped off to the Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded outside of Lynchburg, Virginia. So she gets there at just the wrong time. Virginia has just passed a eugenic sterilization law, and they want to test it in the courts. So they seize on Carrie Buck as the perfect plaintiff in this lawsuit. So they decide to make her the first person in Virginia who will be eugenically sterilized, and suddenly she's in the middle of a case that's headed to the U.S. Supreme Court.
The case was a sham, concocted merely to get the Supreme Court stamp of approval on the issue of forced sterilization. Buck's independent counsel was in fact Irving Whitehead, one of the founding directors of the colony that was pushing to sterilize her, and the man who appointed the director that was pushing for her sterilization. Buck herself was not feeble-minded, nor was her mother, nor was her daughter, Vivian Buck, who Carrie bore as a result of being raped and who was declared feeble-minded as a baby because, as a social worker testified during the trial, there is a look about it that is not quite normal, but just what it is, I can't tell. None of these facts mattered to the Supreme Court. Presided over by former President and Chief Justice William Howard Taft, the court voted 8-1 in favor of upholding Buck's forced sterilization and the constitutionality of the Virginia eugenic sterilization law itself. Writing the decision was one of the most famous and venerated justices in the history of the court, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., himself a eugenicist from the so-called Boston Brahmin sect of the hereditary East Coast establishment. In his decision, Holmes justified the forced sterilization of those like Buck by calling on the government's right to vaccinate the citizens against their will. It is better for all the world if, instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime, or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes, he declared before infamously concluding, 3 generations of imbeciles are enough. And with that, the floodgates were opened. New laws were enacted, and old laws revised to comport with the Supreme Court's decision. Forcible sterilizations, taking place in a covert and low-key manner before, were now reported with pride. A few thousand individuals sterilized against their will became tens of thousands. The eugenics era, brought into being by the immense fortune of the Rockefellers and their ilk, had arrived. And with the aid of a very dramatic push by the Rockefellers, it was about to go international. Beginning in November 1922, and increasing throughout the 1920s, the Rockefeller Foundation began a series of grants and fellowships to German scientists. Equivalent to millions of dollars in today's money, these fellowships transformed the German scientific establishment, devastated in the wake of World War I. The Foundation's money found its way into the coffers of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes, a series of scientific organizations that included an institute for psychiatry and an institute for anthropology, human heredity, and eugenics. One of the main beneficiaries of this Rockefeller largesse was Ernst Rudin, a head researcher at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Psychiatry and a key architect of Germany's eugenics program under the Third Reich. Rudin co-edited the official rules and commentary on the Law for the Prevention of Defective Progeny, which was passed on July 14, 1933, less than 6 months after Hitler was appointed interim chancellor by President Paul von Hindenburg. The law, like the Virginia law that the Supreme Court upheld and led to the sterilization of Carrie Buck and tens of thousands of other Americans, was modeled on Harry Laughlin's model eugenic sterilization legislation. It formed genetic health courts, which could mandate sterilization of defectives in 8 different categories: the feeble-minded, schizophrenics, manic depressives, sufferers of Huntington's chorea, epileptics, those with hereditary deformities, the blind, and the deaf. Alcoholics, a ninth category, were to be optionally added to the list, with a caution against inclusion of ordinary drunkards. By the end of the year, 62,400 Germans were found unfit to breed and sterilized against their will. By 1945, that number had reached 400,000. In the 1940s, that eugenics program was to expand into euthanasia under the Action T4 program, resulting in over 70,000 children, senior citizens, and psychiatric patients being murdered by the Nazi regime. As the dust settled on World War II, the name of eugenics became synonymous with the Nazis in the minds of the general public. The eugenicists, outraged, knew that their work could not continue any longer under the name of eugenics. But that didn't mean that it couldn't continue.
So after World War II, you don't hear about it anymore as eugenics. What you hear is molecular biology and these sorts of colloquial terms that were developed by the Rockefeller Foundation, which was one of the families primarily in America that was helping to fund it in America, in Britain, in Germany, who also funded Hitler during that time. So there's a lot of overlaps between the people who were actually out there funding genocide and the people who had ideas about culling the population and population control and sterilizing people. And these ideas go on and permeate society to this day.
As American Eugenics Society co-founder Frederick Osborne wrote, "Eugenic goals are most likely to be attained under a name other than eugenics." Thus, he moved the American Eugenics Society into the offices of John D. Rockefeller III's Population Council, becoming president in 1957. The Rockefellers and their fellow oligarchs had for generations felt themselves to be stewards of the planet, protecting it from the rising tide of the genetically inferior. They were not about to give up that quest. They would simply have to package it under a different name.
With all the evidence that we've amassed in our preparations for the Stockholm Conference, including the views of many of the world's leading scientists, I am convinced that the prophets of doom have got to be taken seriously. In other words, doomsday is a possibility. I'm equally convinced that doomsday is not inevitable.
On paper, it would be almost impossible to find a less likely candidate for godfather of the modern environmental movement than Maurice Strong. A junior high school dropout from a poor family in rural Manitoba struck hard by the Great Depression, Strong's meteoric rise to the heights of wealth and political influence is itself remarkable. The sheer number of environmental organizations that he founded, conferences he chaired, campaigns he directed, and accolades he received over the course of his career is even more remarkable. Organizer of the Stockholm Environmental Conference, founding director of the United Nations Environment Program, Secretary General of the Rio Earth Summit, founder of the Earth Council and the Earth Charter Movement, chair of the World Resources Institute, commissioner of the World Commission on Environment and Development, and board member of a bewildering array of organizations, from the International Institute for Sustainable Development to the Stockholm Environment Institute to the African American Institute. But perhaps the most remarkable thing about Strong, this ubiquitous figure of the 20th century environmental movement, was his background. A Rockefeller-connected millionaire from the Alberta oil patch who divided his time between environmental campaigning and running major oil companies. To understand how this came about, we have to examine the history of the emergence of the environmental movement. In the post-war period, the desire to control the population put on a new mask, protecting the world from resource depletion, pollution, and ecological catastrophe. And, as always, the Rockefeller family was there to provide the funding and organizational support to steer this burgeoning movement toward their own ends.
President Nixon and the United States Congress established the Commission on Population Growth and the American Future. The chairman of this unique commission is John D. Rockefeller III.
It was a very broad-ranging mandate. Nobody's had one of this character before. And just from that, this question of quality of life just emerged as the seemingly key issue.
But the main finding was that stabilization of some kind is clearly desirable for the country.
Yes, we said that it is recognized that population cannot continue to grow indefinitely. Nobody questions that. And we said from our findings, we felt that now the nation should welcome and plan for a stabilized population. Well, the whole question of pollution, environment, and population came very much to the fore in amazingly rapid time. And President Nixon, in July 1969, made a statement to the Congress exclusively on this question. And I'd like to read just two sentences from that statement, as I think it's indicative of his concern in regard to the subject and his recognition of its importance here and around the world. He said, "One of the most serious challenges to human destiny in the last third of this century will be the growth of the population. Whether man's response to this challenge will be a cause for pride or for despair in the year 2000 will depend very much on what we do today."
Joining the Rockefellers in shaping the international environmental movement were their fellow oligarchs across the Atlantic, including the British Royals behind BP and the Dutch Royals behind Royal Dutch Shell. And facilitating the transition from eugenics to population control to environmentalism was Julian Huxley, brother of Brave New World author Aldous Huxley and grandson of Darwin's bulldog T.H. Huxley. Julian Huxley was a committed eugenicist, chairing the British Eugenics Society from 1959 to 1962. But, like the other eugenicists of the post-war era, he understood the need to pursue the now discredited work of eugenics under a different guise. The founding director of the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, Huxley wrote in the agency's founding document about the need to find ways to make the cause of eugenics politically viable once again. At the moment, it is probable that the indirect effect of civilization is dysgenic instead of eugenic, and in any case, it seems likely that the dead weight of genetic stupidity, physical weakness, mental instability, and disease proneness, which already exist in the human species, will prove too great a burden for real progress to be achieved. Thus, even though it is quite true that any radical eugenic policy will be for many years politically and psychologically impossible, it will be important for UNESCO to see that the eugenic problem is examined with the greatest care, and that the public mind is informed of the issues at stake, so that much that now is unthinkable may at least become thinkable. Huxley found the perfect front for the reintroduction of these unthinkable eugenical ideas in 1948, when he used UNESCO as a springboard for founding the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and then again in 1961, when he used that agency as a springboard to create the World Wildlife Fund. Joining Huxley as co-founders of the fund were not only Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, founder of the Bilderberg Group and former employee of the IG Farben conglomerate, and Prince Philip of England, but Godfrey A. Rockefeller of the Rockefeller dynasty. Together, they pledged to harness public opinion and educate the world about the necessity for conservation. Years of education about the strain that the growing human population put on the resources of the Earth, paid for by the very oligarchs who had just spent the past century monopolizing one of the world's key resources, led, inevitably, to a predictable conclusion.
Now, for the first time in the history of man, an international movement is underway. The people of the nations and the nations of the world have joined together to find the answers. This building and the world's representatives hold the solution. We have seen what we've done to bring about the destruction of our Earth. Is it not the time now to cure the disease that we ourselves have created?
Yes, the cure for the disease of mankind, according to Rockefeller-funded propaganda featuring John D. Rockefeller III as an expert commentator, was to be found at the United Nations, whose headquarters had been so graciously donated by the Rockefeller family itself. And the first step toward discovering that cure was to organize the UN Conference on the Human Environment in Stockholm in 1972, the world's first international environmental conference.
For 11 days in June 1972, Stockholm was a magnet for everyone concerned with the environment. 1,200 official delegates from 113 nations were in Stockholm for the first international conference on the human environment. The meeting, first proposed to the United Nations by Sweden and approved by the General Assembly in 1968, attracted worldwide attention. In 4 short years, the topic of the human environment had gone from the back pages of newspapers to make headlines on page one.
And who better to oversee the conference and lay the institutional groundwork for this burgeoning oligarch-supported movement than a consummate oil man?
The very fact that the conference began with 113 participating countries, with very high-level delegations from those countries, this in itself represented a very significant step forward, because this demonstrated more than anything else the real concern of the majority of countries in the world.
All his life, Maurice Strong had the uncanny ability to be in the right place at the right time to meet the right person to advance up the ranks. Having been born in Oak Lake, Manitoba in 1929, and suffering through the Great Depression, the ambitious young Strong dropped out of school at age 14 and headed north to look for work. Finding his way to Chesterfield Inlet, Strong got a job as a fur buyer for the Hudson's Bay Company, and there met Wild Bill Richardson, a prospector whose wife, Mary McCall, hailed from the family behind McCall Frontenac, one of Canada's largest oil companies.
So Mr. Strong sort of enters the big world through a guy by the name of Wild Bill Richardson, who was a sort of prospector, married into an oil family called McCall, whose company was called McCall Frontenac. It was a major importer of oil from the Middle East. Had been taken over long since by the Texaco company through a brokerage house called Nesbitt Thompson. So in a way, Mr. Strong was introduced to the world of big oil and the world of resources at a very young age, was picked up as a very smart kid, taken under the wing of a man named Paul Martin Sr., who was a cabinet minister and whose son would go on to become the Prime Minister of Canada. And introduced to the oil patch through people at the very top, and that would include David Rockefeller.
Through the Richardsons, Strong made a series of increasingly unlikely connections. First, he was introduced to the treasurer of the then brand new United Nations, Noah Manaud. Unbelievably, Manaud didn't just secure Strong a job as a junior security officer at UN headquarters, he allowed the young Manitoba farm boy to live with him in New York. And while there, Manaud introduced Strong to the most important contact of his life, David Rockefeller. From that moment on, Strong was a made man. And from that moment on, wherever Strong went, Rockefeller and his associates were there somewhere in the background. It was a Standard Oil veteran, Jack Gallagher, who gave Strong his big break in the Alberta oil patch when he quit his UN security job to return to Canada. And when Maurice Strong suddenly decided to quit that oil patch job, sell his house, and travel to Africa, he supported himself working for Rockefeller's Caltex in Nairobi. When he quit that job in 1954 and started his own company back in Canada, he hired Henry Bruni, a close friend of Rockefeller associate John J. McCloy, to manage it, and appointed 2 Standard Oil of New Jersey reps to its board. By his late 20s, he was running his own company, and was already a millionaire. As he would throughout his life, Maurice Strong capitalized on these connections and opportunities to full effect. After being chosen to organize the UN Environmental Conference in Stockholm, he was appointed a trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation, which then funded his office for the Stockholm Summit and supplied Carnegie Fellow Barbara Ward and Rockefeller ecologist René Dubose for his team. Strong commissioned them to write Only One Earth, a foundational text in the sustainable development arena that is heavily touted by globalists as a key document for promoting the global management of resources. The 1972 Stockholm Summit is still hailed as a landmark moment in the history of the modern environmental movement, leading not only to the first governmentally administered environmental action plans in Europe, but the creation of an entirely new UN bureaucracy, the United Nations Environment Programme, UNEP. Naturally, the UN appointed Maurice Strong as UNEP's first director. Shortly thereafter, Strong continued his double life by jumping straight back into the oil patch. Eastern Canada was hit particularly hard by the OPEC oil embargo, and as a result, then-Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau created Petro-Canada, Canada's national oil company. And who did he tap as the company's first president? None other than that crusading Rockefeller-backed environmentalist, Maurice Strong. Leaving that post in 1978, Strong continued with a scarcely believable series of governmental, private sector, and international appointments, from chairman of the Canada Development Investment Corporation to chairman of AZL Resources Incorporated to leading the UN's famine relief program in Africa. In 1987, Strong helped to organize another environmental conference, much less known but no less remarkable than the Stockholm Summit. Dubbed the Fourth World Wilderness Congress, the meeting took place in Denver, Colorado, and brought together Strong, David Rockefeller, Edmund de Rothschild, then-Treasury Secretary James Baker, and a gaggle of other oligarchs, bankers, Washington power players, and globalists, ostensibly to talk about the environment. What they actually discussed was altogether more incredible.
I suggest, therefore, that this be sold not through a democratic process. That would take too long and devour far too much of the funds to educate the cannon fodder, unfortunately, which populates the earth. We have to take almost an elitist program that we can see beyond our swollen bellies and look to the future in time frames and in results which are not easily understood or which can be, with intellectual honesty, be reduced down to some kind of simplistic definition.
Those were the words of David Lang, a banker from Montreal who spoke during the conference. And to Lang, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, and the other bankers and oligarchs assembled at the meeting, the general population are cannon fodder that unfortunately populates the earth. This candid admission, a perfect encapsulation of the eugenical ideas at the heart of the global conservation movement funded into existence by the oligarchs themselves, was caught on tape by George Hunt, a businessman in Boulder, Colorado, who had volunteered to help the conference as a concerned citizen and came away horrified by what he had witnessed there. He released his own recordings of the proceedings in the early 1990s to warn the public about this group and its ultimate aims. Hunt's recording captured the moment when Maurice Strong introduced Baron Edmund de Rothschild, whose father's cousin had sold the Rothschilds' Azerbaijani oil fields to Royal Dutch Shell in 1911, as a pioneer of the environmental movement and a founder of the concept of conservation banking.
One of the most important initiatives that is open here for your consideration is that of the conservation banking program. As we mentioned this morning, we have as our chairman, fortunately, the person who really is the source of this very significant concept. He is one of the trustees of the International Wilderness Foundation, which sponsored this meeting. He was at the first of these congresses. So his conversion to the relationship between conservation and economic development has been a pioneering one. So there is no better person. He epitomizes in his own life that positive synthesis between environment, conservation on the one hand, and economics on the other. And I'm just delighted to have this opportunity of introducing to you Edmund de Rothschild.
Maurice, thank you very much indeed for all that you've said, and I would ask the audience to take with a slight grain of salt all that he has said about me.
The meeting accomplished some important goals for the oligarchs. It led to the creation of wilderness areas, vast expanses of natural terrain from which the public could be largely excluded. These areas were to be designated and overseen by the IUCN, the same body that British Eugenics Society President Julian Huxley used as a springboard to creating the World Wildlife Fund. Another important goal of the conference was Rothschild's proposal for the creation of a so-called World Conservation Bank that would operate at a supranational level and coordinate finance for development projects around the world.
The meetings now of the new concept of an international conservation banking program involves all sectors of the human community, governmental and intergovernmental agencies, the public and private agencies, large charitable foundations, as well as ordinary individuals worldwide. By thinking forward as to how to reach out to the public at large, to every corporate entity throughout the world, to put aside, hopefully tax-free, a part of their profits to fund our ecological and environmental protection. Ladies and gentlemen, every country has its own problems, its indigenous peoples, and its wildlife. This international conservation bank must know no frontiers, no boundaries.
This World Conservation Bank was forwarded and eventually realized at Maurice Strong's next major conference, the one which was to serve as the crowning achievement of his unlikely career as environmental crusader, and which still remains one of the touchstones of the environmental movement, the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro.
In June 1992, the world met in Rio to discuss the fate of planet.
Okay. Now, you would think by listening to some of the statements that the most powerful, wealthy people in the world, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and all their interconnected associates, that they were concerned about the global population. They were. They were concerned about the control of the environment. They were. Why? What was their end game? Now the story gets dark and dirty. Now you'll start to see what emerged. I hinted this recently when I watched Al Gore's film. The film itself makes a very good case and is a very good presentation for what can happen with global warming. But in there, if you did not do your homework, you would not know that his mentioning and showing you and taking you to a solar plant, that he has heavy investments, that he has a $7 billion hedge fund, that he is not looking at tidal power, geothermal power. He is not looking at any of the other powers except solar. Just gives a brief mention to wind and not even the new bladeless wind technology. And of course, he controls this. It shows you as a humble man carrying his own luggage through an airport and riding on a commercial flight. That's not how he travels. It shows a dirt road approaching to his house. He has a mega mansion. That's not. That's like going from your mansion to your barn, and you show you going in the barn as if you live in the barn. It was all very well orchestrated. But this is a man that is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And yet he does not promote veganism. He does not promote the type of behavior that we could lessen global warming. And as a result, he fits right into this model. Remember what they said, capital, economics, and environmentalism. Capital, economics, and population control. Constantly changing when they saw that their names like eugenics or population control were anathema to the average person. We'll continue with three more parts to this, and then you'll see why I'm so concerned about who's leading genetic engineering. Same people. What's their end game? I know it. I'm going to share it with you. Have a nice day. Thank you for listening. Give me now.